Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 66 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Brett Stillo, a filmmaker and former and hopefully future MXM host. Welcome to the show, Brett.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you. It's really great to be here.
And especially with the short notice. I mean, there were technical issues with this entire week's recording. And, you know, I turned to Brett and he was able to step up. And I recorded this entire week's episodes once again with someone else because my original guest wasn't able to come back, unfortunately. So thank you, Mike. Sorry. But your episodes will never see the light of day because
thanks, Mike.
Technical issues.
What can I tell you? And thanks for having me. And yeah, I sort of love to talk about movies. So asking me at the last minute is never a problem. I'm around. I'm available for birthdays and weddings as long as I can talk about movies.
What's the movie that works?
Talk about today.
It's this little indie flick named Die Hard. Did you ever hear of it?
Yeah, I think I saw it on opening night in the summer of 1988. Did you get to see it in its first run?
No, I was 14 when it came out in 1988. So the first time I saw it was when it came out on video about 6 months later.
Okay.
I unfortunately missed it in the theater and instilled it. Up until today, I still have not seen it in the theater. It's something that I'm always on the lookout for, and I haven't yet found a chance to see it again in the theater. But as soon as I get that chance, I will do so. Because I recently saw Jaws in the theater again, and I saw Back to the Future, and it was just great seeing those Back to the Future I saw when it came out in the theater numerous times. But Jaws I'd never seen in the theater. I've seen it tons of times, but it was just so much fun. The theater experience, you know.
Yeah. Another. I definitely know what you're talking about. There's a favorite film, but then when you see it on the big screen, it's just extra frosting on that birthday cake. So,
yes. That is true.
So I hope you do get to see it on the big screen. I had a lot of fun when I saw it on the big screen.
Yeah, have you only seen it once on the big screen?
Once on the big screen, and you know, and so over the years, I haven't seen it a lot, but I definitely have caught it, you know, maybe 3, 4, or 5 times over the years.
In the theater or in general?
Yeah, you know, streaming and, originally like VCR. Yeah, right. I've seen it a few times.
But you also live in California, so you probably have more opportunities to see re-releases in the theater than I do. In Israel, it doesn't happen very often. You know, when I saw that Jaws was out last week, or 2 weeks ago, I didn't really have much time. To, you know, I saw that it was playing, and I was like, okay, I have like 2 days to catch it because it wasn't something that was going to last very long, you know. I was happy to see it that way. So I keep my eye out for that.
Yeah. Jaws on a big screen, cool.
Yes, it was. All right, so minute 66 begins with Dwayne continuing to try and explain his theory, and ends with Holly describing how she feels. So we ended things on Friday with a bureaucrat showing up, flashing his badge and saying, who's talking to him? Who's talking to him? And then we had a little conversation between this bureaucrat named Dwayne Robinson, who is deputy chief of police. He had a conversation with our good friend Al, and Al explains to him why he thinks that we should be able to, trust this guy we're talking to. At this point, Dwayne continues to explain why he thinks that Al might be wrong. And what we heard on Friday was he started saying, has it occurred to you? And today we start with you. So it's, has it occurred to you? He could be one of the terrorists pulling your chain or some nutcase in there. Al's response is, I don't think so, sir. In fact, I think he's a cop. Maybe not LAPD, but he's definitely a badge. So I first wanted to go through some of the phrases that are mentioned here. Like,
sure.
Dwayne has this theory, which we all know that he's supposed to be an asshole in this movie. There's no question about it. Yep. That's the character. That's the way he's supposed to act. That's the way he's supposed to be. But he actually has a point here. at this point. You know, this is one of the few times in the movie where you say, okay, you know what? He's making sense with what he's saying. You know, he might be looking at it from a very bureaucratic aspect, but, you know, you have to be a little bit cautious if you're just listening to somebody giving over information that you don't know who it really is.
Interesting point of view on that. I wouldn't disagree, except it's the actor they cast is one Paul Gleason.
Yes.
You know, you can tell it's an 80s movie if Paul Gleason is in it. And if Paul Gleason is being an asshole,
yes,
which he's doing rather, this is classic Paul Gleason. I just see Deputy Chief Dwayne there. Just being the antagonist, being a perfect foil in the script. You kind of see, you know, why he's there and why he's saying things. Because we can't have the cops helping John.
Right.
So, but you know, it's interesting. Again, it's Paul Gleason's tone. You know, I mean, one thing I wondered watching this scene is it's the hostility.
Yeah.
And you wonder is it just because of Al and his history that this guy should be a brother cop, right? It should be, well, officer, you know, I hear what you're saying, but, you know, I don't want any of our guys getting hurt. So let's be careful. He's really being condescending to this guy.
Yeah, but I don't think Dwayne knows Al's history. I mean, we obviously don't know it yet either, but
yeah.
I don't think, you know, he's saying who's talking to him and he goes, Al Powell, Sergeant Al Powell. So it's like, you know, who are you? I don't really know who you are, you know, but you're right. He's coming there and he's being condescending. But if you think of the words of what he's saying, they're you know, he's saying it in a condescending way, but the content of what he's saying
is
makes sense. That's what it comes
down to. It's just, you know, and it wouldn't be good drama if, you know, he just said, well, Officer Pell, I appreciate what you're saying, but, you know, there's two solid actors here.
Yeah.
And
he plays the character perfectly. The delivery is done in a very assholy way.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. And, you mentioned Dwayne as a bureaucrat, and I would call him a bureau cop. And, you know, this is one of, you know, it's a siege movie, but it's also a classic maverick cop movie. There's one guy he's not even on the LAPD. He's a visiting cop, and it's him against the world. And in the maverick cop movie, of course, you've got the maverick cop, but the maverick cop always needs the high-ranking bureaucratic guy who isn't even on the force. He's not in the precinct. He's the guy who comes to the precinct and says something kind of like, you know, are you arresting anybody? We don't want anybody arrested here. That's bad publicity.
Right.
And you know, all that, you know, don't tell me you arrested him. And it's that you know, it's like Hal Holbrook versus Clint Eastwood and Dirty Harry 2. You know, there's always the guy who shows up in the suit and, you know, he basically says, don't do your job.
Right.
And
more or less
there, you know, he's there to do that. So, yeah, you know, and if they were having more of a professional conversation, there just wouldn't be any good drama there. But, you know, I mean, again, you hire Paul Gleason. It's not Wilford Brimley. It's Paul Gleason.
Yeah, for sure. It's a great casting choice. No question about it.
Yeah.
You know,
they
knew to put in there.
Yeah. And you've also got in the background.
Yeah. This is also 3 years after everyone, you know, got to know him so well in The Breakfast Club. So, you know, it's not as if it was right after. If someone actually thought about it and said, okay, who can we put in this role? And as you said, Wilford Brimley would have been a great choice for an 80s, you know, captain or something like that. Yeah. Not necessarily for this role, but I'm saying, yeah, Wilford Brimley is someone who appears in many movies that way.
Just, you know, if you wanted a gruff but fair kind of a, you know, character, for, I mean, you'd kind of like, you'd hired Brian Dennehy, who'd be like, look, I'm not risking any of our guys. We're going to check this, you know, but no, you got to have someone who is a complete a-hole. And that just happened to be Paul Gleason, who, interesting, I was reading about, you know, he wasn't always that character. His career was much longer than I knew about. He was originally cast in the 50s on The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. You look at him.
Wow.
Yeah, his career went back way earlier than I thought. He was basically like a teenager when he came to Hollywood.
Was he a child actor?
Yeah. not quite a child actor, but he was getting late teens, early 20s. He was getting roles, doing a lot of television. And you look at him back then, it was like, oh, you were an Alan Ruck in the early 60s. You weren't Paul Gleason yet. You were kind of like, you know, gangly, goofy guy. Who then got, you know, gray hairs. And yeah, you know, when I saw this movie, you're right. I instantly remembered him from Breakfast Club.
Yeah.
And it was, oh, it's that guy.
And Trading Places.
You're going to get. So, and that's, you know, that's the fun of certain character actors. You know, you know what Paul Gleason is there for. And he does his job perfectly. You know, I really hate this guy. And you know, you see the tension. It's you know, Al's trying to help John. Al's, you know, it's really just Al and Argyle who are on the outside who can give John any help. And he's
I don't know if Argyle can give him that much help. Argyle can find some mama bears if they need it, but that's about it. Yeah, he's a pimp. That's what Argyle can do.
True, but I mean, it's one interesting thing about this movie is you have playing pieces you forget about, because you know Argyle is there, and we're going to see him in a few minutes to just remind, hey, remember, there's the guy in the limo, and you know he has his everybody has their job in this movie, but
this is based on a novel, right?
Oh yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So, and the character of Dwayne Robinson appears in the novel. He's I think a captain. He's not a deputy chief of police. And he still acts like the bureaucrat throughout the entire thing, for sure. And Argyle's character is an older limo driver who works for, let's say Nakatomi. It's not called Nakatomi in the book. It's called Claxton Oil. So he works for them. And they sent their driver to go pick him up, as opposed to, you know, here, we're not really sure if Argyle, you know, we just know that Nakatomi hired this very fresh and new limo driver to go pick him up, you know, not because he's, you know, he doesn't work specifically for Nakatomi. So.
Got it.
Yeah. So, okay. One of the phrases that our good friend Dwayne says at the beginning is pulling your chain. Have you ever heard that phrase before? And do you know where it comes from? Do you know what it means?
Let's see. It seems like, let's see. The definition is usually, you know, kind of like worse than teasing, goading, a little bit of intimidation, perhaps. But, you know, pulling your chain. It's like you're getting dragged into this, whether you're aware of it or not. You know, I think I would assume it sort of is associated with maybe a draft animal and doing something against your will. Yeah, getting led by, like a bull by the horns.
Okay. All right. So basically the definition is to deceive someone in a friendly or playful way. It's usually playing a joke on somebody.
Okay.
Okay. So pulling your chain is usually a joke. You're pulling my chain. Yanking my chain could also be you know, used instead of that. Nobody really knows the exact origin of where it comes from, but it is connected to the fact that, you know, dogs have a leash.
Yeah.
Right. And when you pull the chain, they stop or slow down because they're then wondering what's going on, you know? So that's the idea of the phrase pulling your chain. Now, it's funny that he would say that, you know, he's saying, you know, I mean, I've mentioned this numerous times over many episodes where we've discussed this, you know, the lackadaisical way that everyone is dealing with this terrorist incident in 1988 is just unbelievable. I mean, obviously, you know, we're now living 21 plus years, you know, past 9/11. But you'd still think that back then, if someone were to say terrorist, you know, they take it a little more seriously. I mean, we can go through many examples in the movie where people are just, you know, laughing off the fact that there's a terrorist. I mean, just think about the fact that they sent Al to go check a crank call at Nakatomi and not say to him, you know, someone says that there's a terrorist incident there, but, you know, so be on the lookout. They didn't even tell him that. They just said, go check out this crank call. Yeah.
That's an interesting point, and I thought about that. I wrote a few notes down when forgetting William Atherton's character, the reporter, his character. But when we get him
a little bit later. We do get him.
I think we're going to have him on Wednesday. But yeah, I kind of took note of what you're saying about how surreal it all seems, and how it did seem surreal in 1988. And yes. Yeah, the laxity
for sure, but just the way that they're acting here, and for him to come and say that it's the terrorist that is one of the terrorists pulling your chain, that the terrorists are making a joke. Like, where does that make any sense?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a couple of moments where that'll come up through the week, but I think there's, you know, in 88, there's definitely that tone of it can't happen here.
Right.
That happens elsewhere. Correct. That doesn't happen here in the land of the free and the home of the brave.
Right.
It only happens in big, crazy movies.
Correct. Even though this is a small budget indie film.
A very lighthearted, irreverent romp with that guy from Lighting who it's so you know, so much of this movie is Bruce Willis and Alan Ruck threw me. Alan Rickman, not Alan Ruck.
Alan Ruck was in a different movie featuring our good friend Paul Gleason. Alan Ruck wasn't. He wasn't in. For some reason, I was just kidding.
Alan Rickman.
Alan Rickman. No, I was thinking for some reason that Paul Gleason was in Ferris Bueller also, but no, he wasn't. That's Jeffrey Jones. Jeffrey Jones. Sorry.
Yeah, but he could have been. And I feel like Alan Ruck today now gets the Paul Gleason roles. You know, unfortunately, sadly, Paul Gleason's no longer with us. But we have Alan Ruck, I think, has that look, and he can do that tone. I'm trying to remember the last time I saw Alan
Ruck. Pardon my French, but you're an asshole.
Yeah. Exactly. I wanted to point out just, you know, again, you can tell it's an 80s movie because of the lens flare. And Mr. Jan de Bont, is it Jan or Jan? I'm going to be American.
I've heard that it's Jan, but I've never met him, and I haven't had conversations directly with him. So, but I've heard that it's Jan de Bont.
That it sounds like the name of, and he looks like one. He could be one of the terrorists.
Yes.
You know, in a perfect world, McTiernan would have put Jan de Bont in a couple of scenes as a terrorist. He couldn't have been like Gudenov's sidekick, but he
could have had Rennie Harland also there, you know.
Yeah, totally. but he was too busy getting just like classic 80s lens flare. And in an 80s movie like this, it's not neo-noir, but it's LA, so if you don't have neon signs, you got to have police lights flashing on people.
Yes, for sure.
So it's just the only thing missing is them hosing down the streets so everything's wet. Because that's something you like. Next time you're watching a good old fashioned like cop movie or a neo noir from the 80s, notice when they've hosed down the street at night so the neon just gets that extra flash. When it's like, has it been raining? There's not a cloud in the sky. No one's wearing a raincoat. It sure looks cool. And Jan knew that, so it was like, yes. I'm picturing him in these exteriors. I need more police cars, more sirens. We need more red in here. Whatever bad accent that was. Sorry, Jan. We're going to get letters.
Yeah. And then he says, or some kind of nutcase in there. All right. Yeah. Now, do you know where the phrase nutcase comes from?
I should, because I am the descendant of almond farmers, almond ranchers, and if they were alive today, it's you can imagine a nutcase being a traveling package for nuts, but to associate it with someone who is unstable, please, Rob, enlighten me.
Okay, so it's first of all, it was first used in 1959 for meaning a crazy person. Okay, so first of all, I did a little bit of research, and there are a lot of synonyms that you could use. You can use kook, nutbag, nutter, odd duck, wacko, weirdo, crackpot, loon, nut, nutbag, nutter, screwball, and wacko. Actually, they're just now. I know I said some of those twice, but those are because it's also from, an insane person. But it can also be in a funny way. You can call someone an eccentric or an odd person. You know, it's not necessarily someone who's completely insane. It's just someone who's a little off, right?
Sure.
And sometimes they behave in a foolish manner. Sometimes you can think of it someone who's behaving in an irrational or unpredictable way. Okay, someone who can be reckless. Or, tend to have violent behavior, things like that. So the truth is that actually does fit John a little bit, because John is a little bit reckless here. He's definitely unpredictable. I wouldn't call him irrational. John is probably one of the most rational people here. I think Dwayne himself is more irrational than John.
Yes, he's highly irrational. Because a screenwriter needed him to be irrational.
Yes.
But we need that tension. If this was a good old-fashioned police procedural, all the cops would be working together. But Jack Webb was already dead for 8 years, so that wasn't
happening. And they hadn't started, Law and Order yet. So
No.
There you go.
Perfect.
They had another 4 years till Law and Order would start. Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly. I'll bet you Dick Wolf hates this movie. He's like, oh, come on.
He's like, it doesn't make any sense.
Oh, come on.
It's not believable.
Exactly. But we're talking apples and bananas. And this movie is bananas. And it's a rogue cop movie.
So at this point, Powell then responds and says that, I don't think so, sir. I think he's a cop. Maybe not LAPD, but he's definitely a badge. So first of all, where do you think he gets this hunch? Why does he think that this is a policeman? What has John said that says that he's a policeman? Nothing. He's given them information. He's definitely, explaining the situation and stuff like that. But what makes him think to say that he's a cop as opposed to, maybe he's just the guy who's seen a lot of cop movies,
I would imagine since Al is a veteran, I mean, this is just pure assumption, speculation.
That's what we're here for, Brett. We're just here for assumptions. You know what happens when you assume.
Now I'm working on some Al Powers fan fiction, but I would assume he probably just picked up on in the midst of it, in a realistic sense, you got somebody who's calling for help, so you don't want to panic them, but you hear how rational or not, like how calm John is being in a very scary situation, and he's giving information. So, and maybe, I can't remember that. Cause that they have a couple of heart to hearts later on.
Yeah.
Cause John's keeping his hands close, or keeping his cards close. So he doesn't tell anybody who he is.
Right. He's Roy. Roy Roger.
Yeah. But you figure Al is a good cop. And he's probably just going, yeah, this guy sounds like a guy I'd work with. Sounds like somebody I know. This guy sounds a little too good or a little too professional, a little too seasoned to be just, a witness.
Or right, but there is, but there is the you have to look at the difference between LA and New York. You know, the way that you police, you know, the way that you look at police in LA and the way you look at police in New York, even in the '80s, you know, they're completely, I guess you could say heaven and earth. I mean, they're completely different, complete opposites of the way that, which is one of the ironic things about the fact that the two of them have such a strong connection in this movie is that, you know, as you mentioned, Al is probably a great cop, but he's a great LA cop. Like you couldn't take him and put him in New York, and he doesn't seem as if he would work as well in New York as he does in LA, at least the way that the character is being played.
Yeah,
you know, and with John, I would think it's somewhat the same, but you know, when Die Hard 2 comes out, we know that they sort of change that because they move him to LA, so he apparently somehow does find a way to fit in. But that's before he has to run back to LA, has to run back to New York for the third movie. So, you know, I guess that didn't work out too well.
All right.
They caught John, you know, beating up Rodney King or something like that. but so, I mean, what Al says here is he says that he's definitely a badge. Now, what do you think badge, what does he mean by that? Like what?
Yeah.
You know, why doesn't he say he's definitely a cop? Like, why definitely a badge?
I wonder if that's just Jeb Stuart or the guy who did the rewrites just having, you know, because cop is so used by everybody. And maybe that's where you talk to a policeman and, yeah, we use he's a badge. Maybe that's a little more insider slang.
Well, it is. You are right. It is police slang, and it stands for bravery, attitude, dedication, guts, and everything.
There you go. Okay. So that's good. That's interesting. So when Al says that, it isn't just, you know, he's trying to tell Dwayne, you know, no, this guy is one of us, and he's a good one of us, and, you know, like. Yeah, because he's probably trying to make a very solid point that, you know.
Yeah. How far back do you think it goes that people have used badges?
Oh, man. A number of years ago, I appeared on the Tombstone Minute, and I think we talked about badges and the origin of badges. And I'm trying to – oh, this is one of those I know I've read about a little bit about the origin of badges and how they develop, but I can't remember. Would you happen to know anything about the history of badges?
Well, it goes back to medieval times.
Okay.
Okay. And it's connected to where knights wore a coat of arms, which represented their various allegiances and loyalties and things like that.
Makes sense.
They could be made from metal. They can be made from plastic, leather, textile, rubber, and they usually are attached to the clothing in order for people to be able to see what, you know, who they are, what they are, right, what they represent, and things like that. Their badges are also used in the military in order to denote various units or which arm of the armed forces one is part of, and things like that, different qualifications that people have received through military training, rank, and things like that. For instance, the Boy Scouts, you know, they also use badges for different types of awards and ranks and things like that. So yeah, it goes back very, very far, and it's still being used.
Yeah.
So it's very, very interesting that you know. But I mean, I personally like the fact that the anagram for the badge, which what we mentioned earlier, you know, I'd never even thought about that beforehand, that it could actually stand for something.
That's cool.
So, yeah, I think so too. So Robinson then says, "How do you know that?" And he goes, "A hunch." Things he said, like being able to spot a phony ID. So, I've always thought this was really funny. I mean, we talked about when they showed the ID, you know, months ago. I think it was Tony's ID. You know that they got things wrong on the driver's license with, you know, it didn't look like a real 1980s California driver's license, but. So I how much do you think it would cost to buy a phony ID these days? I went onto the dark web to try and find out these things.
Well, you went on the dark web. Should we be talking about this?
Yeah, why not? We're just talking. I'm not saying where,
Okay, just the dark web. Yeah, it's you're down the street. I just not too long ago, I was had a vague recollection of being a teenager, and you could, like, in the back of like High Times, you could get a phony ID. There would be an ad. You know, it was sort
For
of.
like a real phony ID or just like a paper phony ID? That had like a picture of Bugs Bunny on it or
Sometimes
something.
I never got one. So, but apparently, if you sent some guy in New Jersey $9, you'd get something that you could get in to see your favorite band or something like that.
Well,
So,
I'll give you a hint. It costs more than $9.
yeah. Oh man, that's a. And I'm funny. I was just thinking about somebody. I was at. Somebody just asked me for my ID, which at this point is like ridiculous. But just the other, but I don't know how much does in current 2022 economic conditions, what is it going to cost me if I want to get a beer and I'm underage?
Well, it's more complicated than that. It's what I looked up was how to get a new identity.
Oh,
So
okay.
therefore you get a whole bunch of different types of IDs, right? So in the US, in order to get a new passport, all right, a driver's license and a brand new social security card and number. Okay. So first of all, the passport will cost you about $710.
Okay.
The ID and driver's license will be 200 plus, and a new social security card number or card is actually only about $5. Doesn't cost that much to do it. If you want to try getting educational certificates and qualifications, those you have to use Bitcoins for. So there's prices here in Bitcoins for that type of thing. If you want to get if you want to start a new bank account, that's about $70. If you want to get new credit cards, that's about $45. And if you want to fix your credit history, that's about $200. Okay, which is considered pretty low for these type of things. So basically, the minimum cost to get a new ID in the US is about $1,300.
But again,
Okay.
that is a completely new like alias and
Yes. Yes, 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 yes. Well, that's why I broke it down a little bit. So that,
because
but
it's
anyway, if you're getting a new passport and you're getting a new ID, you just might as well just go the whole do the whole thing. The passport's already going to cost you more than half. So now, if you want to do it in Europe, okay, it will cost you about another $100. It's about $1,400 to do there. In Canada, it's about the same as in the US, it's about $1,300. The passport's a little cheaper, but the driver's license is actually more expensive. The Canadian passport is only $660 instead of 710, like the American, but the driver's license is at least 275.
Okay. Canada always does it.
Yeah, what can you do? Canada. In the UK, it's also about $1,400 if you want to try and get that. The driver's license is a little bit more expensive also. It's $305, but the passport is the same as the US. It's about $710. But the most expensive place is in Australia if you wanted to completely get a new identity. But that costs nearly $1,500. Again, we're only talking a $100 difference between most of these places, but still.
And I
But
appreciate your in terms of false identities, you're trying to find the bargain for our guests or for our
yes,
listeners,
that's right. So
you
if you're
know.
looking for a false ID, you should probably do it in the US. That
Yeah.
that's probably that that's I think that's the that's the best way of looking
Yeah.
at
You
it.
go to Costco and get an alias and
Exactly.
using a fake Costco card.
Exactly. And so our good friend Robinson's response to this is, Jesus Christ, Powell, He could be a bartender for all we know. So now the irony of this line is that Bruce Willis used to be a bartender before this.
That's true. Yeah,
which true is now, yeah. a great, that's right. It's a great piece of trivia that they fit that in there.
That's a, I wonder if that was a little nod to Bruce or that just happened to be but yeah, and there you go. That's Robinson's.
Well, just... when we get to what do you think? Do you think it was a nod to Bruce or not? When we get to this to the script, I'll be able to tell you what the truth is.
Okay.
So what's your bet? Do you think it's something that's in the script? Or do you think they changed it when they cast Bruce Willis?
I'm gonna say it was an intentional nod to Bruno because that's more fun. So I'll vote with that.
Okay. All right. And we'll hear at the end of this episode whether you're right or wrong.
Oh, boy.
Their argument gets broken up by a comment that someone says on the side that says, TV's here. And then Dwayne looks over and goes, oh,
yeah. If there's anything, any consolation, it's that Robinson is having a bad night. You know?
Well, think about it. Think about it. He's on call on Christmas Eve.
True.
And you know he actually has to go deal with this, you know, this fake terrorist.
thing. And this is I think a lot of his motivation is avoiding things like the media, and yes. having to deal with that. So, but I mean that's.
But it's funny. He wants to avoid it, but he still wants to take the credit for everything.
Yeah. Yeah. No, he's a sh- ass for sure.
Yes.
And no, you know, that's like I said, that as that scene ends, you know, you see like, he's just a very unpleasant and unhappy guy.
Yeah.
Maybe we should be a little more sympathetic for Dwayne.
Nah, I don't think so. Nah. And what I love here is that we get a shot of the TV van and it just like, you know, goes over the divider. The police are like trying to stop him and wave him off. And he just doesn't care. And it's obviously, I'm assuming it's not Thornburg driving. He probably just has someone else driving it, but whoever's driving it is just, you know, they don't care. They're just going to, they want to get as close as possible and they don't really care about the whole thing. And you know, and we hear horns honking and people screaming and stuff like that. But you can't really hear specifically what they're saying.
Right.
And then we get a shot of a portable TV being brought into Hans's office and it gets turned on and we hear music from the TV. And we hear someone on the TV say, I'm not going to warn you again. Now I did a lot of research to try and find where this clip comes from and I couldn't find it. Couldn't find it. It looks like it's from some sort of like Western TV show or something like that, but I couldn't figure it out. So sorry to disappoint everybody. Wasn't able to do that. You know, we just see someone. I was thinking like it's something like maybe Little House on the Prairie or something like that. You know, where someone's getting into a fight because you see the guy wearing the denim overalls and stuff like that. We're taking a swing, but absolutely no clue. So if anyone out there actually knows where it's from, you know, let me know. Did you figure it out right?
And compliments to you for at least digging. That's a deep cut. So you tried.
I did. You're saying I get points for trying. Okay.
Absolutely.
That's good. All right. I appreciate that. So then we see Alexander leave the room after he puts down the TV on the desk. And as he's walking out of the room, he's passes Holly, who walks into the room with a very strange look on her face, followed by Franco. And, you know, at this point, we hear her say, I have a request. And, you know, Hans is busy. And then he looks up and goes, what idiot put you in charge?
Yeah, right.
And I've always loved her response. You did when you murdered my boss.
That is a great reply. And this is an important scene here for Holly because you know, she's held her own pretty well throughout the movie, but now we're seeing just like what she is made of.
Yeah,
come in
for sure.
And face off Hans, who is reminding he reminds me a little more of a British headmaster. You know, he's just looking at his desk, and you know, there's something just maybe slightly ungruber about him here.
Do you know what he's looking at? What would you guess he's looking at? The script will tell us. We'll find out with the script. They never show it to us. We don't get to see it. It's out of frame.
I imagine he's looking at the plan, or maybe he's looking at the weather in Buenos Aires, or where. Not, spoiler alert. Where are they planning on when they escape? Where are they planning to?
They don't say. They just say beach.
Oh, they don't. Interesting. That's one of those I could picture Gruber saying, you know.
We'll be on the beach earning 30%. That's what he says.
Yeah.
Doesn't say anything about where.
I am gonna step down. And what is he looking at?
Right, well, no, I'm not gonna tell you yet. We'll get there with the script.
Oh.
You're gonna have to wait. You're gonna have to wait a little bit. Just a little bit more.
Yeah. I'm
a little bit more. Now, funny thing is that why is she in charge? You know, Ellis is theoretically high, ranked higher than she is. You know, she was talking about the fact that months ago we talked about this, that you know, she was hoping to get Ellis's office with his private bathroom, which they were in when she says that, made that comment, because she's in Ellis's office. So Ellis is obviously higher ranked. I mean, obviously he's coked up and nobody's going to look to him for advice. Anyway, that's a separate issue. But the idea that she says that you put me in charge when you murdered my boss. Now everyone's looking to me. So, you know, but this also says a lot about her character. You know, we've had this discussion and debate throughout this entire podcast as to, you know, what did Holly do before she got the job in Nakatomi? You know, she it wasn't if she was just sitting at home doing nothing, and then she answered a little ad for this company, you know, that's looking to hire someone in L.A. You know, she's a very high level position. You know, it's not something that she had to be working for it. So John, you know, John might have animosity towards her about the fact that she moved to L.A., but whatever her position was, you know, she's still at a high position in some company in New York beforehand. So he should have been used to the fact that she has, you know, this high level position.
Yeah, I mean, I mean, this scene says she's just a natural leader.
Yeah, for sure.
And it may be, she says that line, but I think it's just her just probably doing what she has a natural gift for. And that's, you know, like, okay, let's get organized. Let's do this. You know, I can imagine Holly's a character who, starts off maybe as a secretary. But just with her I think, inherent natural leadership skills, she probably gets a lot of fast promotions.
Yeah, she moved up really quickly.
I think it's like, you know, John's sort of like, I think he's maybe not used to her in such a position. He's like, how did you get to be here, you know? And it's just,
Right, but it wasn't that she was a secretary in New York and then answered an ad for the job in Nakatomi. You know, this is a high level position. It's, she needed to go through stepping stones before she can get there.
Yeah.
You know, it might have been a jump, but it wasn't a jump from a secretary to being, you know, she was already a businesswoman, even if it was medium level before she jumped up now to the high level, you know, that type of thing.
Yeah. Interesting.
As we see in the next movie, I mean, she basically gets Takagi's job. So, you know, it means she does have the qualifications for all that.
But that's, you know, I mean, if you save your staff from a terrorist attack, you get promoted.
Yeah, I guess. Well, especially when the two people above you both get their heads blown off, you know.
Maybe nobody wants that job, but. I mean, I'd say that's an interesting point, because I think when, you know, we see Holly initially were seeing her through John's point of view. And I think he's sort of been oblivious to her career as well. I think that's part of the problem is,
yes,
he's, you know, he's maybe only now on Christmas Eve realizing, like, yeah, she makes four times what you make.
And four?
Deal with it.
I think I would think even more than four. She'd make it a lot more. I mean, we discussed weeks ago about the salary of a New York City cop and how the salary of a LA cop is actually much higher. So it is to
oh,
John.
Really?
It behooves John in 1988. It behooves John to actually move from a financial perspective.
So,
we'll see.
So I had one.
Let me just finish with what she said. Finish with her line here, and then we'll get to that. Okay, so then she says, he says, "What did he put you in charge?" And she said, "You did when you murdered my boss. Now everyone's looking to me. Personally, I'd pass on the job. I don't enjoy being this close to you." she gets that jab in there right at the end, also.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it works very well.
Yeah. And I think this is where, yeah, I noticed, you know, Rickman looks a little startled, or, you know, Gruber looks a little like, you know, it's a very comical double take expression that he's sort of like, whoa. Good job by Rickman to sort of show Gruber's surprise at her tenacity. But I had to make a joke out of it that, you know, Rickman is just like, he doesn't know what to think of Holly's 1980s perm. Because it is.
No, but he's seen her before. So
tumbleweed in that. You know, it's funny. I hadn't seen the movie in a few years. Of course, knowing it was made in the 80s. And, you know, when you see, you just suddenly see Holly, she looks so 80s businesswoman. And her hair looks like you could actually cut your fingers on it. It just looks like this. That's a hell of a perm, Rob.
And maybe, course, that's the reason why John, you know, needed 6 months away from her to let his hands, heal. Who knows?
Exactly.
All right. Is there anything else you want to say about this man before we get into the script?
I just definitely wanted to say something about Holly's perm, which it's a little bit of a cheap shot because that was the era.
Yes.
And it was funny looking at Bonnie Bedelia pictures of her in the 70s when she had more of like straight hair. She sort of looked like Susie SpaceX sister or something like that, but it's the 80s. You know, it looks like she might also have some padding on her shoulder pads. You know, just that was the look. Dynasty.
Yes. That's right. All right. So the script has just a few minor discrepancies, nothing really major. But first, we'll talk about the two things we discussed earlier about, you know, whether the phrase of bartender was added in for Bruce Willis. And the answer is no. It was already in the script. So sorry, Rel. You missed on that one.
That's okay. That's okay. Still a good line.
Yes. No, for sure. Completely. Now, the script actually mentions that Robinson notices himself, the TV van showing up, and no one has to say to him, TV's here. You know, he looks over and then he goes, oh, shit. That's his response to the whole thing.
Okay.
Then when Holly comes into the room, so I will read you what it says here. Hans examines building plans at Holly's desk. Behind him, the TV is on, sound muted. TV cops triumph over oafish bad guys. Okay, so he is looking at the building plans, which makes sense. I mean, if you look at what he's doing here, you can see that he's looking at something, even though it's out of frame. It still looks pretty good.
Yeah.
A few other minor differences. In the script, it's Fritz who brings Holly in instead of Franco. It means the same thing, but it doesn't matter which character. Right. They just change the character of who it is. And then the final thing that it says here right after, you know, she says to him, I don't enjoy being this close to you. It says, Hans is impressed by her candor, and she's easy enough on the eyes.
Yeah.
Which, you know, interesting for them to say it that way. But, it works that way.
Yeah.
All right, so every Monday we have a segment called Die Hard on a Monday, where my guests will give their top five diehard doppelganger films. So, Brett, what have you got for us? Start with your number five and work your way up.
Oh, well, I went in kind of a different direction. I'm doing some deep cuts. I thought about movies, favorite movies of mine that might have had some inspiration with Die Hard, because, you know, 1988, this seemed like a really amazing fresh movie. Not that it wasn't, but, you know, you see elements of it in earlier movies. Not, you know, I think Die Hard really just, you know, puts the pedal to the metal with it. But, you know, like in the 70s, on my list, I'll start number five. There's a great hostage melodrama movie, The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3. Have you ever seen
that? Oh, I love that movie.
Yeah. I mean,
I hate the remix, but the original is amazing.
Yeah, the original. And, you know, you kind of wonder if
I actually hope that I'm going to do that one in the future. That's a great.
Yeah.
It's on my list. It's very high on my list.
That's a good one. Yeah. So you kind of it's not a clear line through, but I think you see some of the inspiration for that, you know, and like,
well,
we
know
Shaw's,
that
was he Mr. Green in that? And that's, you know,
Terrence. Mr. Blue. That's Mr. He's Blue. Mr. Blue. Mr. Green is Martin Balsam.
Okay. Man, you know your Pelham 1-2-3. I bow my head towards you. So, yeah, that's one where, you know, I feel like there's a little bit of DNA there. I'm going to go back to another favorite of mine. You know, that's the theme of, you know, one man against the system, or, you know, one man on his own. And Point Blank with Lee Marvin, 1967. Little different, because that's just a criminal who's tearing up the mob. But what's important is that movie was based on a novel by Richard Stark, a.k.a. Donald Westlake, who did it's one of the Parker crime novels. And we can also talk about, you know, the novel inspirations. You know, he did a great book that's never been properly done as a movie called Slayground, and it was written before, and I just forgot the title of the novel Die Hard's based on.
Based on Nothing Lasts Forever.
Nothing Lasts Forever. Roderick Thorpe and Nothing Lasts Forever. And Richard Stark, Donald Westlake in 1971 wrote Slayground, which is set in an abandoned amusement park in the dead of winter. And it's the same kind of cat and mouse where the hunter becomes the hunted and vice versa. And, you know, I have to wonder if Roderick Thorpe, he might have even been pals with Donald Westlake. But there's some interesting parallels in that novel, which was never properly done as a movie, should have been a movie. I think it was made as a movie in 83, but it wasn't so good. And then got a couple more. I'll go back all the way to 1932. Because, you know, Die Hard is totally a cat and mouse movie, and the hunter becomes the hunted and vice versa. And the definitive movie of that is one of my favorite movies, The Most Dangerous Game. It's the classic story of, you know, the hunter becomes the hunted. And it's got a great British actor who was, I think, the Alan Rickman of his generation, Leslie Banks. He's even got a beard. And it's a totally fun movie, Precode. And then I'll take it back to what I think is the very first modern action adventure movie. And this is about some guys who steal a train and one guy trying to get it back. And that is Buster Keaton in The General, one of my favorite movies. 1926, 1988. There's about 60 years.
1925, isn't it? Isn't it 25?
Yeah, 20, I think. 25, 26, definitely in there. But, you know, The General is just...
you're right. It's 26. I bow to you, Brett. It's 26. Sorry.
Oh, it's okay. I mean, your dart was right next to my dart. The fact that you were that close is, you know, hey. I'm a big fan of The General, and, you know, I feel like... Steven Spielberg and Jackie Chan and John McTiernan and a lot of people need to they erect a statue to Buster Keaton, who I think was kind of the, in some ways, the first action movie star and filmmaker, because there's a, the tempo of that movie and the way that, you know, it's got gags, but it's still like an elaborate chase and there's tension. I'd like to see a silent version of Die Hard made in 1927 with Buster Keaton.
Or that Harold would be Lloyd. Very, very interesting. Yeah, I'm a big Harold Lloyd fan. Yeah.
Oh, gotta love Harold Lloyd. Yeah, I think, you know. So that's, yeah, and, you know, I think, you know, and to kind of tie it, take it back to 1988. You know, we love John McClane because he's a very capable hero, but he's also, you know, there's, you know, we wince at some of the jams he gets in, but there's also humor to it. We kind of laugh along with it, even if sometimes it's nervous laughter. Oh, gosh, that's horrible. But, you know, it's, and this movie absolutely has comic elements to it. And yeah. Those are my, was that five?
I actually only counted four. Taking a Pound, 1, 2, 3, Point Blank, Most Dangerous Game, and The General.
Yeah. And also I'll throw in two more. I'll do a daily double. John Carpenter's original Assault on Precinct 13, that kind of a siege movie, very low budget. Again, don't bother with the remake. And the movie that inspired that, Rio Bravo, with John Wayne and Dean Martin, Howard Hawks, one man against an army.
I love how they just start singing in the middle. You know, it's just like, they got nothing better to do, so let's just sing. And it's just fun, you know. Yes, it's very fun.
That might be the one missing element of Die Hard. And maybe if Bruce had – his career was a little further along and, you know, this movie put him on top. But if he was already on top, he was – you know, I'd really like to sing in this one. And I guess he sings – doesn't he like Ti-Yi Yippee-Yay? That's not quite singing. But anyway, he could have done a number just, you know, in the middle. Suddenly there's a piano in the Nakatomi Plaza and he –
Yeah, but he would have had to have Dean Martin in with him, you know, and then that would have made it a little more sense, you know. If you had Dean Martin there, then you know, I think it seems more in the Towering Inferno. It would have made more sense, you know, for them to sing, you know, either Cindy or My Rifle, My Pony and Me. You know, those might have fit in a little better.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right.
That's excellent. You know, the Towering Inferno is also, you know, different movie, but I think every movie I've mentioned has some DNA to it, and you know, I hand it to the producers for creating, you know, making a great goulash and creating a very original movie that way. But yeah, those are my five and I'm sticking to them.
All right. Very good. All right. You want to tell people how they can get in touch with you, Brett?
You can send me an email or a text. I'm on the Facebook. I'm not retired, but I don't have a current movie by minute podcast.
You're on hiatus.
But I'm always available to talk about movies because I have nothing better to do. My good friend Josh Horowitz and I did 5 minutes of Banzai, all about the adventures of Buckaroo Banzai across the eighth dimension, and 5 minutes of Trouble, where we discussed Big Trouble in Little China, which came out about 2 years before Die Hard. And the connection there is Al Leong, which we'll talk about more about him throughout the week.
All right. Great. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. Or you can go directly to my website, movierobminute.com. So, Brett, you feel like coming back again tomorrow? Talking a little more about this little indie film, Die Hard?
Yes. Yes. Quiet little movie.
All right. Great. So, until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.